This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Hello again. I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, and you are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today. Finally on the show today, the news cycle regarding medical matters has slowed down enough for us to do some of the things we've wanted to do for a couple of months now, namely get some really great guests on the program and let you listen to somebody else besides me rambling on and on for an hour. Today, I am very excited to have one of the smartest people that I know as a guest on the program. Her name is Sally Pipes. She is the president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute, which is a great think tank. She is one of the great thinkers and writers of our time on a number of topics, including, of course, healthcare policy, which is what we'll talk about today. Sally's qualifications would take the whole hour to go through, but she has been on a number of news outlets, Fox News, NBC, ABC, CNBC, MSNBC, writes for Forbes magazine. So the great thing is the places that she goes and does what she does covers the political spectrum. From one end to the other. I was privileged to hear about Sally a few years ago when Docs for Patient Care was started. And we had some trips to Washington, D.C., but I finally had the privilege and the pleasure of meeting her at the Steamboat Institute meeting, which was a couple of months ago in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. So we are very honored today to have Sally Pipes with us. Sally, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Mike, and I'm a huge fan of yours and Hal Schurz and Felicia and Docs for Patient Care. It's a wonderful organization which really is out there educating Americans on, you know, where doctors are on Obamacare. So keep up the great work.
Well, thanks so much. We'll do the best we can with help from folks like you. So tell us a little bit about your group, the Pacific Research Institute, you know, what you do and how you do it and how it fits in the big picture.
Well, Pacific Research Institute started in 1979. It's a think tank. And actually, on October 1st was my 23rd anniversary of being at the helm of PRI. I don't know where the time has gone, but, you know, we started out, you know, fighting a single-payer initiative in California and then Hillary Care and then Obamacare. So healthcare reform is a big part of PRI's agenda. But we also work in other areas, education reform. We support charter schools, school choice. A number of issues were anti-Common Core, which is a big issue right now.
Oh, yes.
In the curriculum for K-12 students. We work in the environmental area, and we just released a study comparing each of the states on environmental regulations, and it turns out the worst is New York. California is the second to last, but states like North Dakota and Texas have the least regulations and are actually booming. So we work in that. We have the Laffer Center. Art Laffer set up his Laffer Center at Pacific Research Institute, and we have a lot of interesting things going on there on the whole supply side economics. Is our new book, The Pillars of Reaganomics, looking at what made Reagan great and what made the economy boom. So those are some of the issues that we focus on. While we're based in California, headquartered in San Francisco, a hotbed of liberalism, it seems sort of oxymoronic that we're there, but our founder was living in San Francisco at the time. But a lot of the work that we do is national in scope, and in particular, the healthcare work that I do is national in scope, and I'm just really passionate. Being a former Canadian who grew up under a single-payer healthcare system, Medicare for all, I'm passionate about not allowing the government to fully take over our healthcare system, and I'm very much pushing repeal and replacement of Obamacare.
So Sally, this we're very close to the one-year anniversary of when Obamacare went live, right, October 1st of 2013. And Obamacare's goal, as we talked about earlier, was twofold, right, to reduce the number of uninsured and to reduce health care costs. So 1 year out, how's it going?
Right, and of course, Obamacare is 4.5 years old. It seems, you know, March 23rd, 2010 was a long time ago, and there have been a lot of problems. And as you say, the two main goals of the president were universal coverage and bending the cost curve down. What we have found is on the cost curve, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has just recently come out and said that today we are spending about 18% of our gross domestic product on health care, about $3 trillion a year. It is the most of any country in the world. But the shocking thing is that as the president wanted to bring the cost curve down, they are saying that by 2023, the United States will be spending 20% of its gross domestic product, or about $5.2 trillion on health care. So the cost is not coming down. Also, the president wanted a health care bill that cost $900 billion over 10 years. The Congressional Budget Office did an analysis of the law when it was passed and said they saw it as about $940 billion over 10 years. That was from 2010 to 2019. But however, they've now adjusted that number to about $1.4 trillion from 2014 to 2023. And interestingly, Bloomberg government just came out last week and said, to date, Obamacare has cost $73 billion. So if you bring that out 2015 to 2024, we're probably looking at a health care bill that costs around $2.6 trillion. It's a far cry from the president's goal of bringing the cost curve down.
Well, and that was look that at the 900
uninsured,
million. Go ahead.
Uninsured, he wanted to eliminate that about 40 million uninsured people. Just because you don't have health insurance doesn't mean you don't get health coverage. But Congressional Budget Office has just said we're still going to have 31 million Americans uninsured by 2023. So neither of his goals have been or will be achieved with the Affordable Care Act.
Well, that original $900 billion figure had a lot of accounting sleight of hand behind it. I think even at the time, there was plenty of reason to doubt that figure, and people had brought up that that was 10 years worth of billing and only about 6 or 7 years worth of, in quotes, benefits. So even from the very beginning, that number was bad, and now we're sort of getting, I guess, some more accurate renditions of that now that, you know, Nancy Pelosi's dream has come true, right? Pass the bill to find out what's in it.
Right.
And so, sure enough, we're finding out what's in it, and the first thing we're finding here, it sounds like, from the numbers that you give, Sally, is that the first thing we're finding is it's over twice as expensive as it was forecasted to be.
Well, and as you know, Mike, government statistics are always a little bit, you know, suspicious. If you look back in to 1965, when Medicare and Medicaid came into being under then President Lyndon Johnson and his Great Society program, when Medicare came into being, they predicted it would cost $3 billion in the first year. And by 1990, Medicare would cost about $12 billion. In fact, Medicare in 1990 cost about $110 billion, also 10 times what the original estimate was. So even if I think the number for will be around $2.6 trillion for the decade starting next year, I think it's probably even low, because no government program ever seems to cost what government predicts, and there's always some fudging going on in the numbers to make a program look better to the electorate than it actually is.
Well, certainly, and you know, that number is probably going to, you know, double, probably close to five, you know, trillion by the time it's all said and done. Why do you suppose that happens? I mean, it seems to happen with every government program, just that there's no competition and no incentive for the government to do as efficient a job as possible. True.
Well, that's exactly it. When you take out competition and efficiency, you're going to get exploding costs. Because in Canada, where I'm from, you know, the government spends about 11.4% of gross domestic product on health care. And so people like the president, Nancy Pelosi, they say, well, why are we in America spending 18% of GDP when Canada spends 11.4%? Well, that's because the government runs the health care system in Canada. Private coverage is outlawed under the Canada Health Act, and government says we'll spend that amount of money. Unfortunately, the demand for health care is much greater than the supply, and so in a country like Canada, you have long waiting lists, rationed care, and lack of access to the latest technology and treatments. The average Canadian today waits 18 weeks from seeing a primary care doctor to getting treatment by a specialist. And so, you know, that's what happens when government takes over a program, because they had no idea in Canada back in 1974 that you know, people, when they think something is free, they demand a lot more of it. And under Obamacare, you know, with the subsidies and all of the issues, you know, there's going to be a lot more cost involved. And there, you know, if you look at the tax increases under Obamacare, they're around $1.2 trillion over 10 years. But will all that revenue come in? I mean, there's already discrepancies with, you know, what revenue is coming in from the medical device tax. The Cadillac tax was delayed till 2018. So government is not efficient, and government should not be in charge of our healthcare system. In fact, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services came out just recently and as well and said that we don't have a free market in healthcare in this country. 46% of our healthcare is already in the hands of government through Medicare, Medicaid, the program for low-income Americans, which is being expanded in many states under Obamacare, the CHIP program for children, and, of course, the Veterans Administration, which has been, you know, there have been a number of fraud issues, you know, have just recently been exposed there, showing a lot of delays in the system that is actually a single-payer system for our vets.
Oh, yes, and that the whole VA scandal that's come out in the last few months, and the very first show that that Hal and I had here in June was a long expose of all the stuff that had been discovered about, you know, secret waiting lists and vets dying to get care. And I've got an article of yours in front of me talking about a 76-year-old Navy veteran, and this kind of touched me because I'm an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and this guy had to wait 2 years to get a biopsy for a cancer on his nose that ultimately, cost him a rather disfiguring operation because of the delay. And, that's just really sad, unfortunate stuff. And, in a system, in the VA just kind of mirrors what's happening with Canada and with the United Kingdom and other countries that have this single-payer system, is that there is no downward pressure on costs except to ration.
Right. And that's how they do it. And I don't know if you saw, but on September 27th, last Saturday, the Swiss that had an initiative on their ballot in Switzerland for a single-payer healthcare initiative, and it was the third initiative brought out by sort of liberal politicians and some consumer groups, and it was defeated handily again. But, I think the Swiss are probably smart enough to realize they have a private system, private insurance system, and they probably see the British papers every day have stories about fraud and abuse of patients and lack of care in Great Britain, and so they voted resoundingly to not introduce a single payer system, which is good. My ultimate worry for this country is if Obamacare fails, then the president and people like Pelosi will say, well, we tried, a competitive market system, i.e. these exchanges, which aren't competitive markets, and therefore we really need to go to a Medicare for all system, because I believe that is what President Obama has as his long-term vision, because he said it, many times back in 2003, 2004, that if he were setting up a healthcare system, that's the kind of system he would design. And of course, the American people are impatient. They don't want the government. They don't really like government. And 59% of Americans polled today say they would like to see Obamacare repealed and replaced. They have an unfavorable view of it. So when you see in the media that, the American people are, they're settled with it, they like it, it's a success, the American people don't like it, and the numbers are there to show that.
Agreed, and I remember seeing all those things as well, and they sort of tipped their hand saying those comments years ago, that's what they were really after. And some of the early iterations of Obamacare before it passed, if memory serves, correct me if I'm wrong, had the government option, so to speak, and had a model built into place that would allow the government option to survive on taxpayer subsidies while, giving it an unfair competitive advantage over whatever product the private sector would be allowed to offer. True?
Right. You're exactly right. I mean, the House bill, which, of course, Nancy Pelosi was the speaker at the time, had the public option in it. With the reiterations back and forth between the Senate and the House, Harry Reid, the Senate majority leader, said they had to take out the public option. But he has said himself in media interviews that his ultimate goal, too, is a single-payer system. He said, I'm absolutely for that. So you can see their colors, but that public option was in the earlier rounds of the Affordable Care Act, but they felt that they wouldn't be able to get it through, so they settled on, what we have today under Obamacare.
Good deal. We are coming up on the break. We will be back in a couple of minutes with Sally Pipes from the Pacific Research Institute. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host for this week, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you so much for joining us today with our very special guest, Sally Pipes from the Pacific Research Institute. Sally, we were talking about Obamacare in the first segment, and I think we're going to move on to some of the threats from without that's coming to Obamacare from different places. And we were talking about some of the court cases, so why don't you tell us about those?
Yes, well, I think the court cases are very, very important. As everyone remembers, back in June 2012, Justice Roberts voted with the other side of the court and ruling that the individual mandate under Obamacare was constitutional under Congress's power to tax, which was really a shock to many of us. We thought that, you know, that the U.S. Supreme Court would say that the individual mandate was not constitutional, and so it was a tremendous shock, and it kept the law in place, as well as with the November 2012 election, with President Obama being reelected, Obamacare is still the law of the land. However, there have been a number of cases that have come before various district courts, and there's some interesting decisions coming out of there. One, in July, U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. District ruled in a three-judge panel that 2-1 that the subsidies from the federal government to those individuals who live in the 36 states that did not set up their own health care exchanges were illegal. And so if you remember, a number of states, I think the president and the various people in the administration thought that every state would set up their own health care exchange. But in fact, 36 states decided that they would go with a federal website, healthcare.gov. And so there was nothing in the law that said subsidies could be paid to those individuals who weren't in state exchanges. So that was a very good ruling from this two-judge panel in the D.C. Circuit Court. However, on the same day, the Fourth Circuit Court in Richmond, Virginia, their panel ruled that the subsidies were legal. So there's a number of things going on right now. The plaintiffs who lost in the Fourth Circuit have appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court for cert to have the Supreme Court, one would hope, accept this case so that they can rule, the Supreme Court can rule on whether or not subsidies being paid to individuals in these federally operated exchanges in these 36 states are legal. Interestingly, they haven't accepted that yet, but it's a very political decision as well on the D.C. Circuit with that two-to-one judge panel decision. That court decided a short time ago that they would do an en banc review of the case, which means all of the justices in the D.C. Circuit would have a chance to vote on this. So that's interesting. You know, will the Supreme Court make a decision on cert prior to the en banc review? And that could take, you know, up to a year to get a decision. But it was very important that yesterday in the Oklahoma District Court, in the case Pruitt versus Burwell, that is Scott Pruitt, the Attorney General's case against Sylvia Burwell, the Secretary of HHS, that court ruled that the federal subsidies to those individuals in federal exchanges were also illegal. So we've got a lot going on there. I think, you know, this is very encouraging for people like myself who think that Obamacare is not the way to achieve affordable, accessible, quality care for all Americans. We need a health care plan that empowers doctors and patients, not the federal government. So it's going to be very, very interesting. I think the Supreme Court is definitely, you know, going to have to seriously consider taking this case, because now we have two decisions that are saying that the subsidies are illegal, and one saying they are legal in that Richmond Fourth Circuit Court. So, you know, who knows when the court will make their decision, and if they do decide to take the case, you know, when will they actually start the case? Because, as you know, President Obama is in office until January 2017, but depending on timing, you know, there may be an election, and the whole structure of the House, the Senate, the presidency, they may be different. So I think it's very encouraging for those people like myself who oppose Obamacare that these decisions are coming down right now.
But for somebody, you know, far, you know, knowledgeable like yourself, I mean, the rest of us kind of look at all of these contradictory court rulings and don't really know whether we should be encouraged by it or discouraged by it. And certainly, you know, a lot of the talking heads will, you know, spin it one way or the other. But for you, your net assessment of all this is that you're encouraged. At least we're ahead 2-1 in court rulings. I mean, that's kind of the primitive logic that I use. Not very good, but at this point, nothing really meaningful happens unless the Supreme Court chooses to take it on, and then it's you have the if question and the when question, and I guess those are all still very up for grabs.
Right, and I think for those of you, you know, for those of us like yourself and Hal and myself and many others who follow this all the time, you know, John Gruber, a professor of economics at MIT, who was very much involved in the writing of the Affordable Care Act and before that in Romney Care, I mean, he publicly stated that the subsidies were designed for only those exchanges that were state-run exchanges, say like a covered California or a cover Oregon. Then he tried to backtrack and say, no, that's not what we meant. And the IRS, of course, has been backing the whole idea that the subsidies were for everybody, not just for those in state exchanges. But the good news is that it was on record in some speeches that Professor Gruber said they were really designed for people in the state-based exchanges. So that was an interesting thing. It was very good that was revealed. I think the reason that Gruber said that, I think back in the day when this was all being set up, I think that the president, people like Professor Gruber, all thought that every state would run to the drawing board and set up their own exchanges. But as you've seen, that the cost of these exchanges, the website glitches, security issues, you know, it just became, you know, many states just said they couldn't afford to do that. And we've seen not only problems with Covered California, Cover Oregon, but, you know, when you look at all the problems with healthcare.gov when it was supposed to be released October 1st, opened for sign up on October 1st, 2013, you know, the cost has just been unbelievable. And in fact, Bloomberg has said that the cost of setting up healthcare.gov already is at $2.1 billion. So double what we were advised by the administration and the president back in the beginning. And of course, they never had any idea of the glitches. Remember when Kathleen Sebelius was Secretary of HHS, even a month before, 2 weeks before, she kept coming out and saying everything's on target, healthcare.gov is enrolled, it's going to, you know, come out as we planned. And then, of course, it was all of these glitches and problems, and now they're hiring Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, the Secretary of CMS, is hiring all these sort of hotshot techies to try and sort out the problems that still exist.
Sure. And so what happens, Sally? Let's assume a you know, what I think for you and I would be a best case scenario, that the Supreme Court takes this case and rules that subsidies for states that chose to go with a federal exchange and not set up their own. What happens to the folks that have already received subsidies, and what happens going forward if the it's ruled to be unconstitutional?
Well, I mean, the issue will be, will those 36 states that have been, you know, under healthcare.gov, will they say, well, we need to rethink this, we're going to set up our own exchanges? And I think that probably is not going to happen, because they've seen how expensive Covered California, Cover Oregon, how those states that have actually done it have actually, you know, what they have encountered. So I think that is not going to be a solution, although a number of people, you know, on the people who are proponents of Obamacare think that will happen. So it's going to be an interesting thing, because you know, if they rule that the subsidies are not legal and people have, you know, received them, are they going to have to return them? Will the government say, well, we'll let you keep them, but you're not going to have access to subsidies anymore? I think that really breaks down the whole employer mandate, you know, because any employer with 50 or more employees is subject to the employer mandate. And of course, the president earlier this year decided that, you know, they would have to delay the employer mandate till January 1st, 2015, for those employers with 100 or more employees, and they delayed it till January 1st, 2016, for firms with 50 to 99 employees. That's being delayed. That was like a two-year delay. So this will really break down the whole issue of the employer mandate, which then I think will result the fact that Obamacare is not going to be able to survive. And, you know, while I'm a huge proponent of repeal and replace, if the court ruled this and this caused it, it would be much better than, you know, a political overturning of Obamacare, because I think, you know, the Supreme Court is, you know, sort of the highest law of the land, and I think it would be better if that were the case. But ultimately, I still favor repeal and replace, but it can't happen until early January 2017 in full. It can't happen in full because it assumes that the Republicans would take the presidency, keep the House, and also take the Senate. They may take the Senate this November and get a majority. They won't have a supermajority, I'm sure. And I'm still a little bit nervous about, you know, how the outcome of this November's election will be for the Senate. But anyway, to go through the political process of would definitely be January 2017. But I really would hope, my hope is that the Supreme Court will take it and that we will see this will be the way that Obamacare will fall. And then we have to work very hard to design a replacement plan that, as I say, empowers doctors and patients and not the federal government. And we can talk about various ways later that could be accomplished.
So if the Supreme Court were to rule this, the subsidies to be illegal, I mean, does the other side, the non-supporters of Obamacare, have to have something ready at that moment to replace it, since it's almost null and void right then? Or how ready do people who oppose Obamacare have to be?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but in August, a year ago, in August 2013, former Speaker Newt Gingrich was speaking at a Republican event in Boston, and he said the problem is the Republicans have no plan for replacing Obamacare. Well, you know, he actually was not telling the truth, because there are many Republican plans out there from Dr. Tom Price from the House. Senators Coburn, Burr, and Hatch have a plan. Paul Ryan has a plan. There are many, many plans out there. I have a plan. Obie Roy from Manhattan Institute has a plan. The 2017 Project has a plan. But there's not one single plan. And I think, you know, what the Republicans need to do is sort of stop fighting like cats in the laundry bag and get together and come up with a plan, because all of these plans have many issues in common that would be part of a good replacement plan. So I think, you know, they need to get together and come up with what their plan would be so that they're ready. Because, as you know, the people who are proponents of the law and Obamacare, they keep saying, well, the Republicans have no replacement plan. They don't know what they're doing. I think it would be really good for them to develop a plan now so that it's ready to go, whatever the situation is. Because if they don't, then they're just going to be criticized, and the American people are going to say, well, okay, we view Obamacare in an unfavorable light, but, you know, but we don't know what's going to happen next. So I think that it's really important that the Republicans be ready with their plan for whatever, whether it's a Supreme Court decision or whether it's election results in November of 2016.
Okay. All right, we'll pick this up in the next segment, Sally. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings for Medicine on Call and participate in a lively conversation. Learn what's happening behind the headlines in medicine. Understand Obamacare, and learn how to protect yourself and navigate the system.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. people all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak here with Sally Pipes from the Pacific Research Institute on the Doctor's Lounge at America's Web Radio. The Doctor's Lounge is where you get to hear the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves and about the topics that are important to us. And with me today is Sally Pipes, the President and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute. We were just talking about some of these Supreme Court decisions, but we're going to turn the topic of the conversation to some of the declining enrollment issues and some of the other sort of problems that Obamacare is bringing upon itself. So go ahead, Sally.
Well, I think, you know, the president in April stood up and told the American people that Obamacare was a success. You know, let's stop talking about this. Let's move on. He said he had reached his goal of 8.1 million people had enrolled in the exchanges, in particular healthcare.gov. I think it's important that to know that of those people, of those 8.1 million, 87% of them were eligible for these subsidies, which we, the taxpayers, you know, are paying. But, you know, so much for his excitement about, you know, the success. There were two issues that those of us who oppose Obamacare were worried about. What percentage of those people will actually have paid premium? They may have signed up, but have they paid their first month premium? Are they continuing to pay premium? And the second issue is, you know, are all of those people legal? Because, you know, under Obamacare, you were going to have to prove your citizenship and your income status. That was part of it. But then President Obama delayed 1 year the income verification issue. So, you know, we've seen some fraud in that. So just a couple of weeks ago, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services came out and said, well, the 8.1 million number had to be downgraded to 7.3 million. And the reason for that is that 800,000 of those people had not actually paid the premium. So the president's, you know, great high sign about how successful it was, that has been revised downward to 7.3 million. And then the other point is they say there will probably be another 110,000, 112,000 people who will be removed from the list because they can't prove their citizenship. So, you know, he was premature in his victory speech. Mark Bertolini, who is the head of Aetna, he reported just recently that they had 720,000 sign-ups for Aetna plans on various exchanges. But by June, they found out that only 600,000 of those people had paid their premium, and they're predicting by year-end they will only have 500,000. So, you know, it's one thing to sign up for coverage, but it's another thing, you know, have you paid for that coverage? Because if you turn up at a doctor's office or a hospital and you actually haven't paid, you know, it's going to, you know, you're not going to be able to get coverage. So this is a big, issue when we're finally finding out what, you know, what the numbers look like.
Well, some of those rules are very unfriendly to doctors, too. Correct me if I get these details wrong, but I think if you're behind on your premium between 30 and 60 days and you go and see a doctor, the doctor has to eat that cost. They're not going to get paid. I think in the first 30 days, the doc gets paid, but from 30 to 60, I think you have to provide the care, but there's no obligation for anyone to pay you.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And so, you know, this is not going to be, you know, very, very good news for doctors. I don't know if you've been following, but there have been a lot of surveys coming out about, you know, what do doctors think about Obamacare? And Deloitte had a study that came out showing that 60% of the doctors they surveyed, plan to retire in the next 1 to 3 years. And the main reason is because of Obamacare and the sort of clamp on their ability to practice medicine, all the bureaucracies, electronic health records, all of the regulations things. So that's a very telling number, because if we're adding more and more people to coverage, if we have fewer doctors, we're going to see, you know, waiting lists develop. And certainly, I don't know if you saw this, but the Colorado Hospital Association came out with a study just recently that showed that 24 states that had expanded their Medicaid program, the program for low-income Americans, there was a 5.6% increase in emergency room use in those states that had expanded their Medicaid programs. And we saw this earlier in the state of Massachusetts under RomneyCare. So, you know, doctors in many cases do not take Medicaid. They may have, you know, their care card, but doctors are not taking these patients because they're reimbursed 38% to 42% below what they get for treating a regular patient. So, you know, you may have Medicaid expanded coverage, adding 7 million to the Medicaid rolls, but if they can't get a doctor, they're turning up at an emergency room, which is very expensive care, and which was one of the things that the president wanted to get rid of, this whole issue of uncompensated care by emergency room use.
Well, and I can just tell you as a doctor that a reimbursement at that rate, it costs me more to take care of a patient than what you get paid under that kind of a system. So it's worse than working for free. I mean, I would have to write a check back to my practice out of my personal funds to cover the overhead for that patient, because there's not even enough to cover the overhead.
Right.
So it's no wonder.
And then, I don't know, the Physicians Foundation, which does a lot of surveys, they actually received 20,000 responses in their survey to doctors. And of those, 46% of the 20,000 who responded graded Obamacare either a D or an F, failing grade, for what, you know, for the law. And only 25% said they supported Obamacare. So doctors are finding out now what really is, you know, behind this law and why it's harmful to them. And that's why I think organizations like Docs for Patient Care are so very important, because you can educate doctors on what this is meaning, what this law means for their ability to practice medicine. They're not happy. And as we add more and more people to the roles of the insured, if there are fewer and fewer doctors, we'll have waiting lists, just like they do in Canada and in the United Kingdom and other European countries. It's very disturbing.
It's an intellectual sleight of hand that the supporters pull by getting you to assume that by putting a card in your hand that actually equals access to care, because clearly it doesn't.
Right, and there was a Supreme Court case in the early 2000s in Canada over the issue of access to care in the province of Quebec. And the Canadian Supreme Court is not a conservative court at all. But Madam Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin ruled that the ban on private insurance and private health care in Quebec was illegal. She said having access to a waiting list is not access to health care. And so that is something that I think people really need to be aware of. And the Association of Medical Colleges came out, you know, recently saying that by 2023, we're going to have a shortage of 130,000 primary care doctors and general surgeons. So this is going to put even more pressure on those doctors who remain in business, and we will see, waiting times develop, and also docs not taking, you know, Medicaid patients or in some cases, Medicare patients, because the rate of reimbursement on Medicare, while it is higher than it is for those on Medicaid, it's still below, you know, in many cases, you're not covering your costs.
Well, and it's the only reason that those programs survive at all is because of the cost-shifting phenomenon, that you have to have a certain proportion of private insurance patients in your practice in order to afford the losses associated with the federal programs.
Right, exactly. And so this is not good news for those people who think well, you know, now I'm covered. There was a poll that came out also recently showing that of the people who are uninsured, only 27% think that Obamacare is the solution to the problem. So, you know, while we have 59% of Americans supporting repeal and replace, when you have people, people who are uninsured not thinking that this law is good for the future of their health, it's also an important statistic.
Well, it's the people that Obamacare professes to help are these folks. And if you can't win their hearts, then who are you going to convince? I mean, these are the folks it was intended to help. And, you know, it seems to be losing on both fronts, right? The cost curve was supposed to go down. It's going up. The number of people that were uninsured was supposed to go down. It's certainly not going down. And I think I saw some numbers last week that it actually went up a small tick, depending on whose number
right.
you look at.
And, of course, it was very odd that the Census Bureau decided to change the way they measure the number of uninsured in this country starting this year. So you can't compare apples to apples in the, who was uninsured in 2013 versus today. So I thought that was very interesting. But I think, you know, we are seeing that the number of uninsured is actually, you know, has a slight uptick. And, of course, many of those people, of the 43 million they say are uninsured, it doesn't necessarily mean they don't get health care. They just don't, they may pay for it privately. A number of these people are young people who, you know, are going to pay the penalty, the individual mandate penalty, rather than buying coverage, because it's the younger people, the 18 to 34-year-olds, the young invincibles, who are having to, you know, pay much higher rates for coverage than they did before if they had coverage, in order to cover the older and sicker people who use a lot more of the healthcare system. And so, you know, there's a number of issues there, because the people that have enrolled have been the older and sicker, not the young and healthy, who pay for these people who are older and sicker.
Yeah, that whole psychology and finances all got messed up because the risk pool is not what they expected it to be. And if you're a 25-year-old who's healthy, I mean, why would you pay premiums that are clearly going up year after year? I mean, the penalty's a better deal.
Right. And if the president promised us prior to the passing of the law, and even after it passed, that the average American family would see their health coverage go down by $2,500 a year, and the Congressional Budget Office has, you know, shown already that the average family is seeing their premium go up by $2,100 a year. So that was a lie, and we're certainly, when the average premium in the silver plan within the exchanges is about $346 a month for an individual, you can see why a lot of young people would say, this is not a good deal for me, because I'm a young invincible and I'm not going to need, you know, this coverage. I will pay out of pocket if I have a problem.
And better yet, if you do get sick. If you do get sick, I mean, you can't be denied for your pre-existing. So, you know, buy your insurance in the ambulance on the way to the hospital and you haven't lost anything.
Right. You know, you can't, under Obamacare, preventive care is free. There's no limits on the amount that can be paid out in claims, and you can't discriminate based on pre-existing conditions, and price can only vary three times based on your age and your health condition, price of premium, and it should be at least five times as much for people with pre-existing chronic conditions. So Obamacare has put a lot of things into place that, you know, make it more difficult and more costly for people to get coverage.
Okay, in the next segment, we'll talk about solutions. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on americaswebradio.com.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs.com. 4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org, and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You're listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek. We are here with honored guest Sally Pipes from the Pacific Research Institute, and we're spending our time today talking about Obamacare, since we are near the first anniversary of Obamacare's go-live, or healthcare.gov's go-live. And we spent the last three segments talking about some of the problems that Obamacare's facing. We're going to spend the fourth segment on solutions. So, Sally, if somebody died and made us king and we could fix this any way we wanted, what do we do?
Well, I mean, I think all Americans agree. We all want affordable, accessible, quality care. And the question is, how do we get there? And, Mike, I think you and I would agree we want to empower doctors and patients, not the federal government. The people on the other side of the aisle, the people that support Obamacare, believe that, you know, we need a health care system that, you know, is based on increased taxes, increased mandates, controls on insurance companies, all of these things which empower the federal government, not doctors and patients. And I think when people are in charge of their own health care, they will make informed choices about the type of health care that suits their own needs and those of their families. Milton and Rose Friedman wrote a famous book that was published in their languages all over the world called Free to Choose. Let's let the American people be free to choose. So if we, you know, put on our rose-colored glasses and look into the future, I really think, I support repeal and replace, and I support an agenda that supports empowering doctors and patients and not the federal government. You know, it was the federal government that got us into this whole mess in the first place during World War II, when wage and price controls were in. Employers were finding it hard to, you know, attract new employees because they couldn't, you know, offer, you know, more money. And so, as a plum to employers, the federal government said, well, you can write off the cost of providing health coverage to your employees, and employees will get their health coverage with pre-tax dollars. And so the federal government got us into this mess, and now, you know, the problem is, if you work for an employer, and many employees, you know, are being moved now under Obamacare to part-time work. We're seeing companies like Home Depot, Target, pushing people into part-time work, working fewer than 30 hours a week, so they don't have to provide coverage and pay this mandate penalty. So, but if you are an employee and you lose your coverage, you go into the individual market, you have to buy your insurance with after-tax dollars. So one of the solutions I have is to change the tax code so that individuals, if they lose their job, can purchase insurance in the individual market with pre-tax dollars, just like the 160 million Americans who have today employer-based coverage. This would allow leveling of the playing field, and I think ultimately will move people away from employer-based coverage to individual coverage. So that is one of the key solutions to changing the tax code. I think, you know, we need to really expand health savings accounts. I don't know, Mike, whether any of your patients have health savings accounts. They're the accounts where you put the money into the bank account, you carry it forward tax-free, you combine that with a high-deductible insurance plan, so in the event that you do get something serious, that you do have, you know, you do have coverage. But we've seen a tremendous 17.4 million Americans now have health savings accounts, and a lot of employers are offering HSAs to their employees, because they are a way to reduce costs, because you're putting people in charge of their health care. So,
well, we have an HSA in our family, and of course I do see a lot of patients with health savings accounts, so I've seen both sides of the equation, and there is no question that it changes spending habits. And folks who, you know, they get sticker shock when they realize that the care that they're getting, once it's costing their own dollars. And yeah, you see decisions that are far more intelligent and far more frugal in terms of the the healthcare decisions they make, and the folks that don't have HSAs. I mean, the history lesson that you bring up with the Stabilization Act of 1942 is a good one, because it changed the mentality of what we call health insurance, but isn't really health insurance. It's a benefit program, and I see people all the time without HSAs who say, "Well, I've paid my premiums. I want to get something back out of it." And so part of their motivation is that the premiums they pay, it's an investment. They should be getting back more than they put in. This whole idea of risk goes out the window.
Right. And as HSAs expand, and more people have them, more people are asking, well, if you go to the hospital and they say that, well, an MRI that you need would be $1,000, well, then they're saying, well, I'm going to check with a MRI imaging unit down the street and see. And so there will be more transparency, because people will shop around.
Yes.
And decide on which is the best cost, which is most cost effective for them. So I think it's really a good solution, and was part of President George W. Bush's, one of the accomplishments that I really liked about. I didn't like everything about his administration, but I think HSAs was a good one. I think also, the issue of high risk pools, we're always being criticized. Well, there are people out there who have chronic or pre-existing conditions, and if we got rid of Obamacare, they wouldn't be able to get coverage. I think one of the things that could have been done and should be done is to, if the feds want to do something, is put more money into high-risk pools, so that all states have high-risk pools, and so that when people, until we get a properly functioning market, if they put 50 to 100 billion into the high-risk pools, we could get these people covered until we get a properly functioning market, and then they would be able to be part of a much larger pool, and so we could pull that funding back. But I think we need to think about, how do we transition from what we have today and to a post Obamacare Affordable Care Act. So I think that is one positive thing that could be done. We need to, really reduce these mandates on insurance companies. Before there were about, all states have mandates, most have 40, 45 mandates. There are about 2,100 mandates on insurance companies across the country that you have to cover when a person buys coverage, whether it's in vitro fertilization, alcohol rehabilitation. But all of these things add 15 to 20% to the cost of a premium. If I want a health care plan that covers alcohol rehabilitation, I should be able to get it. But Mike, why should you have to pay for what I want? You may want a plan that covers in vitro fertilization, because as a man, you may be thinking about getting pregnant, but I don't want that. So, these benefits, and then Obamacare on top of that added the essential benefit plan, added 10 more mandates to the plan. So, free preventive care, free ambulatory care, free maternity training, once you've had your baby. All of these things are additional costs, on the program. So instead of adding to the mandates, we need to reduce these mandates and let people decide what type of plan is best for them.
So, it would be very emotionally satisfying to draft a bill that's one page that says everything that's in the Affordable Care Act is now null and void. And there's a lot of support for that and a lot of disagreement among opponents of Obamacare of how to undo it. But what are your thoughts on the best way to handle that?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to either have a Supreme Court decision that helps us or in the election. But I think, I think, as I've said, as people have been very upset, with the smaller hospital networks, doctor networks, the whole issue, I think it's going to be interesting when people file their tax returns, how complicated that is, if they've been receiving subsidies. I think, we look at the numbers. So I think if we have a good plan and show people that they are going to be able to, be covered and get access to care and not be facing long waiting lists, that this can be done. But we have to have a bridge to transition. And so things like, expanding the high-risk pools, limiting the mandates. I think this definitely can be done, and the Republicans have to get together and say, there are a couple of things that are very popular under Obamacare. One is children being able to stay on their parents' plans to age 26, the issue of no limits on the amount of size of claims that you can get, and, of course, no discrimination based on price, based on your on your health status. So the Republicans need to come up with a way to how do we put market incentives into these issues that are, that actually are popular. But instead of having the government making decisions about what is the essential plan, what, you know, putting limits on insurance companies, let's let the market work, and it can be done. I mean, we're looking at, as we said earlier, a healthcare plan that's probably going to cost, you know, over $2.6 trillion over the decade. Taxes are up by, will be up by $1.2 trillion over 10 years. You know, companies don't pay taxes. Government doesn't pay taxes. We, the American people, are the people that pay taxes. And when we see our healthcare costs going up with less access, I think we're going to see, you know, more dissatisfaction. We have to decide. I mean, do the American people want the government to be in charge of their health care? Do they want, you know, a PPO to be in charge? Or do they want to be in charge of their own health care? And I think that is the American way, and I think that's the way we have to move forward.
Agreed. So, last topic, you know, what do you think? I mean, some people in response to this argument would say that, you know, accountable care organizations with this new sort of bundled payment system, we've got about 2 minutes to talk about it, but some people think this is the panacea and the way out of a lot of different things. I've even heard people talking about electronic medical records saying that doctors won't buy in unless they're in an ACO. But is that going to save us?
Well, ACOs were a major part of the Affordable Care Act, and really originally set up to reduce costs among the Medicare population. You remember the president saying, you know, we need, if we had bundled payments, we could reduce the cost of health care, and accountable care organizations are the way to do it. And, you know, we've got, you know, some tremendous examples of integrated health care systems with Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, Geisinger. Well, you know, Cleveland Clinic, Mayo, these integrated systems didn't sign on with the whole idea of the accountable care organization because they could see that their costs would be going up and they wouldn't be able to provide the kind of care that they're used to providing for their patients. So we have seen the RAND Corporation has just done a study of accountable care organizations and bundled payments in California. They started out, there was a pilot program for which 8 hospitals in California signed on and 6 insurers. Well, after a short time, you know, the idea was that that bundled payments would end up with reduced costs between 25% to 50%. Well, pretty soon, only 2 hospitals had dropped out and of the pilot program, and costs are up. I mean, they were supposed to be for 6 chronic conditions, and the Hogue Orthopedic Institute in Newport Beach, which was one because it's very easy, you know, if you need a knee replacement to actually look at, you know, how would you bundle payments, you know, with the orthopedic surgeon and all that. And they found their costs went up and they couldn't provide, you know, the kind of care that people were used to. So the pilot program has been shown to be a disaster in California, and the government has said they want to have 6,500 accountable care organizations with these bundled payments. How many have signed up so far? 235. You know, it's just, it's failing to reduce cost, and it's harming patients. So bundled payments is not the way to go. We need to allow doctors and patients to make decisions about what is the best type of care, what kind of, you know, care. No doctor wants to have to readmit a patient to the hospital because that you know, their condition has not been solved. But when you have ACOs and doctors and hospitals are being reimbursed for reducing costs, you know, they're going to reduce the quality of care. And so bundled payments have not proved in this California pilot program to have worked. So, and docs and hospitals are not signing up in droves. As I say, 235 okay. only have okay. signed up.
Well, we're at the end of the hour, my friend. Thank you so much. We've been honored to have Sally Pipes, the president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute, on the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Thanks for listening.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.